Hello and welcome to Lush. In 2016, naturalist and broadcaster Mary Colwell walked 500 miles across Ireland, Northern Wales and England to raise awareness of how the once common curlew was disappearing from the countryside. As she wrote at the time, "I undertook this walk alone and unpaid. I am passionate about saving these birds." My name is Charlie Moores, and in the years that have followed, Mary has written a book about her travels, Curlew Moon, won the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust Marsh Award for Wetland Conservation, launched a charity, Curlew Action, and launched a crowdfunder to help her create a practical online guide to all things curlews called the Curlew Fieldworker Toolkit. That crowdfunder met its target just days before I went across to Bristol to talk with Mary for this interview. And as I discovered, her passion for curlews is burning as brightly as ever. I began, though, by asking Mary to describe the thinking behind the setting up of the Curlew Fieldworker Toolkit.
It was inspired by the realisation that as curlews have gone on up and up the conservation agenda, because they're in such serious decline, a lot of people want to work on them, and a lot of people write and say, "What? How can we get involved? You know, I want to go and help." And volunteers are absolutely essential to help conservation work. We all know that. I mean, conservation relies on volunteers.
Permanently under-resourced.
Permanently under-resourced and permanently under-trained. So training people to do a job properly is not something that's very easily available in the conservation world. So training of volunteers is very hard to get, I would say. It requires organisation, it requires some money, and it requires all kinds of understanding that and getting people together. This problem was becoming more and more obvious, and we decided that we'll bring all the received information together in one place, online, and call it a toolkit. If you decide you want to go and work on curlews, you'll need to know an awful lot of things. You'll need to know when the birds arrive on their breeding grounds. You'll need to know what calls they're making and how the calls are changing. What about their behaviour when they're beginning to mate and settle and lay eggs? Where are the most likely places for them to lay their eggs, you know? And then when they've laid their eggs, curlews are so annoying, they have the most difficult nests to find on the planet. How are you going to find those nests and check that how far on the eggs are? And if you are approaching a nest, what's the law? Yeah, really important. Yeah. All those things you need to know. And then when you found the eggs, there's very strict laws around what you can and can't do. Lots and lots of technical stuff that you can do if you need to. There's lots of things that you need to know. Now, that information is already out there, but it's so desperate you'd have to be an Inspector Clouseau to find it. So the idea of the toolkit is to bring that together into one place so that a field worker or a little conservation group or a curlew group say, okay, I heard this call today, let's check what it is. How many eggs? They've only got two, you know, we expect at least three, if not four. That kind of thing. I saw a male doing a particular flight. I bet that means it's got eggs, or it's still got the female, you know, the female still sort of hasn't decided whether she's going to mate or not.
Right.
All that stuff. It's technical, it's detailed, and it's vital if we're going to do it properly. And if we don't know how to do things properly, we can end up damaging things. You could easily walk over eggs. You can easily scare birds getting too close. You can miss signs and therefore miss what's going on.
Are curlews sort of harder then to work with than other shorebirds? I know, for instance, Wildfowl and Wetland Trust have worked with the godwits. Do curlews present special problems?
They tend to be so shy and flighty. They're very nervous of people and they can see you from a long way away. So it's hard even to get within half a kilometre sometimes.
As a birder, I should know that, but I imagine that they were breeding on farmed fields where people were going up and down with ploughs. And I could imagine that they were quite used to people in some respects, but you're saying not.
Well, they're very cryptic. So if they think you haven't seen them, they'll sit pretty tight. You're quite right. In places where they are very heavily visited, say like in Gloucestershire, they often nest in these big flood meadows. And very often there's dog walking track all the way around the outside, or in the New Forest, one of the most visited national parks in Britain. As long as people stay to the tracks, they know that you're not a danger. It's when people start sort of walking around and stopping and, you know, they pick up on signs really quickly. But they are known to be quite a flighty, scared, nervous sort of bird. So they are difficult to get close to. And they're very cryptic. They're very good at hiding. They can disappear into nothing so quickly.
There's still more to learn, isn't there? There are things you're telling me now that I didn't know about curlews that I assumed I just knew because that's how shorebirds behave.
There is so much we don't know. And because not many of them have been ringed, really, we don't know whether particularly whether they're faithful to one partner. We don't know that. We don't know whether birds come in. It seems that some birds, juveniles, come back and kind of pretend that they've got a territory, but they don't really. We didn't know until recently, until we put GPS tags on birds, how far they're travelling at night when they're in the breeding seasons. A female or a male, they share incubation, will be sitting on the nest at night, and their partner can fly 3, 5, 10 kilometres away. As soon as it goes dark, they've gone. They'll fly quite a long way and roost, say, next to a little tarn or a little lake or by shore, and then they come back just before it gets light. So they are nighttime travellers, and we didn't know that till we started tracking them. They're also very big travellers as they're coming in to breed. They travel widely around an area, always sort of looking, sussing out what's going on, perhaps sort of, well, who knows what they're looking for? We just don't know. But most often they'll go straight back almost to the same dandelion and lay where they did last year. But they're sussing the area out and they're looking. They can travel 500 miles or so around the area just looking. Now, that's quite interesting because in the breeding season, if you see a curlew flying over and you keep seeing it, you think, oh, that's a breeding bird in my area. It might not be. It might be from 200 miles away. So it might even be double counting. The amount of new stuff we've learned over the last 4 years is phenomenal. A lot of the calls, we're not quite sure what they mean, but they're subtly different. People are noticing very soft, gentle hooting noises, which we didn't know about before. All sorts of things going on.
Who's the we in this?
Oh, we is just a wide variety of curlew groups. The ones I'm most familiar with work in lowland farmland. They tend to be small, locally led, volunteer manned little projects in southern lowland Britain, who just love their local curlews and are keeping an eye on them. And those groups are the ones which have been monitoring them for a long time and have noticed the declines and have been saying, something's going on here, help, And that's mostly the people I've been working with through this thing called the Curlew Forum, which helps connect all these groups together and provide support.
Are these the same groups that are putting information into the toolkit?
Yes, absolutely. So the toolkit will be a broad sweep of people who know about curlews on the ground, getting their information, being able to collate it in a really understandable kind of flowchart way, you know, bullet points, things you need to know quickly on the ground. And that will then will also then be collecting case studies. So those people will say, well, in my area where it's got very long grass and very flat landscapes, hard to see the nest. So this maybe rope dragging is quite a good way to find a nest. But if you're in more upland areas and you've got a vista, you've got a viewing point and the vegetation isn't so high, you probably don't need to do that. Case studies, habitat variation, that's the kind of thing that we'll be able to bring together.
Wow. So this is going to be a large website in the end.
It's going to be quite large and I'm sure will grow over time. It isn't going to just be written and finished.
Right.
We'll be adding to it as new information comes in and as new areas say, or, you know, new people come up and say, well, this is my experience. It's a living, growing thing, and I hope will be an absolute sort of treasure trove of curlew wonder, you know, that will really inspire people to say, well, yeah, I can do this. I understand now what I need to know to get to get these birds monitored and safe.
In theory, then, anyone could input, but presumably it'll be edited.
Yes.
There's a team overlooking, or is it not just you?
Not just me.
Again.
Two wonderful field workers are actually writing it at the moment, and they are going around interviewing key people, and we're collecting any information that comes in. So, yeah, there's lots of stuff going on. There's a website, curlewcall.org, and if you've got information, please send it into that, and we'll assimilate it.
You had a crowdfunder recently, which was pretty successful. What were you planning to spend the money on?
Doing just that, paying the people to collate it, to put it online, and also, crucially, to hold a series of workshops. So the workshop is an essential side of it. So the toolkit's there, but if you're a bit unsure or, you know, you just want to discuss things, then these workshops will be rolled out around the country. So you can go free of charge and meet curlew lovers like yourself, and you can say, I've got this particular problem, or I'm not sure how to put up an electric fence, or every time, you know, the birds get predated, you know, how do I know what's predating them, or whatever your issue is, yeah. There'll be people there to share that field knowledge with. So this is for field workers. This is not great lofty science or anything like that. This is for people who get their hands dirty in the field.
Field workers and lofty science do go together sometimes, obviously.
But it's not just a sort of academic exercise. Yeah. This is for
practical
on the ground.
Can I suggest you call them curly clinics? Because I love
alliteration. Oh, curly clinics. then people will bring in their sort of curlies with a headache or something.
Curlies. When do you think you'll be able to start rolling those out?
We've got our first workshop. We're planning it for the first week of March.
So for this breeding season?
This breeding. That's why we wanted to crack on. And if anybody still wants to donate, please do through my website, curlewaction.org. That's got a donate button. And the more money we raise, the more of these workshops we can hold, and the more we can get field craft out there. And the field craft will certainly be great for curlews, but a lot of it will overlap with other species as well.
Sure, yeah. For you, having curlews back in the landscape is really important, isn't it?
No, it's just so important because, you know, man cannot live by bread alone, really, can we? And having those birds that sing in that soulful, evocative way, it just does something to your spirit, and I think it makes us much more aware that we live in a living, breathing world rather than a concrete jungle. Curlews are really important as sort of wild poets. They just sing their hearts out to us, and we respond on a heart level, I think. But they're also telling us about big landscape changes. So as the birds disappear, or as they increase in number, which I hope they will, they'll be saying, look, you're getting this right again. You're re-wetting the ground. The insects are coming back. We're cutting later for silage, so we've got time for the chicks to survive. There's lots of things that they're telling us that we're doing wrong and hopefully in the future doing right. So getting curlews back in the landscape is a matter of aesthetic, but it's also practical.
Right, so it's not just about having curlews. What you're saying is if there are curlews, then we have also fixed the landscape.
If we've got curlews,
that's a great way of looking at it.
It is. If you've got curlews, you've got lots of healthy invertebrates in the soil because they've got that big long bill that goes into the soil and eats. So they've got lots of worms and grubs to eat. There's also lots of insects on the surface for their chicks to eat. It means that wildflowers can grow better because you're not cutting it for silage from April onwards. So we're leaving wildflower meadows to develop. And so what they're saying is they're telling us that the landscape is beginning to recover. And as curlews spend the winter on the coast and they breed inland and they do these staging in between the two, if they're getting between their wintering grounds and their breeding grounds in a healthy condition, we've got good coasts, we've got good meadows and mountains, and we've got nice healthy farmland in the middle.
It's much more of an emblematic bird than I'd actually given it a lot of thought of before I started talking to you, actually, a couple of years back.
It is absolutely emblematic, and it's a wonderful bird to coalesce around. I think maybe we talked about this before, that curlews are not controversial. I have never, ever met anybody who wants to kill a curlew. Well, actually, that's not quite true. They do in France.
They do in France. There was a quota for 6,000, which got withdrawn, didn't it, in the end, under conservation pressure.
Luckily, that has been stopped in France for this year anyway. But on the whole, curlews are protected throughout Europe. They are not controversial. They don't incite angst in any way. They're just a lovely thing that we like to have in our environment. And so they bring different sorts of people together. Perhaps people that wouldn't normally particularly see eye to eye.
Yeah.
They all can say, actually, I love curlews and I want them back. And so they're a great binder of societies, if you like.
Right. Would you say then the decline is almost accidental? The change has happened and the curlews lost out?
Curlews are absolutely collateral damage to an intensively farmed...
That was a phrase I was looking for, Mary. Collateral damage.
Collateral damage to an intensively farmed landscape. Nobody wanted to get rid of them. But then on the other side, they're not economically valuable either. So you wouldn't particularly look out for them. So the way that we farmed the land and we drained it and put in fast-growing ryegrass and we cut it very quickly, and also something about intensively farmed landscapes means there's lots of predators in them, like foxes and crows, that take advantage of all the easily available food. Curlews just got hit from every single angle and started to disappear. So it wasn't a deliberate eradication, but it's a sad indictment of the way that we've treated our landscapes.
Have the farming community Are they part of the toolkit? Because they're obviously part of the solution, without a shadow of a doubt.
100%. And it has been so good to find farmers, barely anybody who doesn't want to get involved. That, you know, farming community do care about the land and they do care about wildlife that lives on their landscapes. Yeah. That's been my experience. Obviously can't speak for every farmer in the country, but the ones that I know of and have come across, I haven't met anybody who doesn't care. And so tapping into that understanding, those people, those land managers, those farmers who know their land every single day, they know what their land can do and what it can't do. So their involvement is absolutely crucial. Without working closely alongside farmers, understanding and you know, benefiting from their knowledge and them understanding why things might have to change, that's the powerhouse. That will be what will drive change in this country.
Do you think part of the answer is that will be key is whether grants are accessible from the government, say? Because the reason silage is cut early is so there can be several cuts.
Oh, absolutely.
If you remove one of those cuttings, then
absolutely
they're going to have to pay for feed for livestock.
They are. And that's, you know, and it goes, how far back do you want to take this problem? So the reason that farmers have to cut so many cuts of silage is because there's so many dairy and beef cows in this country. And so we have to keep feeding them through the winter. There's that many dairy and beef cows because we eat a lot of meat and drink a lot of milk.
Yeah.
So it goes back to the consumer again, doesn't it?
Yeah,
so everything's tied in.
Always entangled.
It's there a massively a entangled web of which every single person in this country is part of. So we can't just say, oh, well, I don't see curly, so they're nothing to do with me. You know, they are absolutely 100% to do with you and to do with me and to do with everybody else.
I was just going to say it's so easy to blame farmers,
yes.
whereas I think that it's the farming systems that we've allowed to be put in place as consumers that are contributing to a lot of biodiversity problems we've got.
We can't blame the farmers. They're a supply industry. They're supplying what we ask them to supply. And so the ask has to be different. And the ask has to be different. And we have to understand that these people need to make a living too. So there is a great understanding that that needs to happen. And so there are meetings taking place. In fact, Prince Charles is getting quite involved in this, and he's holding a meeting in Highgrove next month to bring national agencies together and the farming community and NGOs and conservationists and you name it. And everybody's going to say, how can we make the post-Brexit farming system work for wildlife? And for curlews, because he's a great lover of curlews.
Is he?
Huge, yeah. Who knew?
I did not know that.
That Prince Charles loves curlews. And many, many people do, because they are just wonderful birds.
And like you say, they are non-controversial. It's very hard to say. It's for anyone to say, well, no, we can't have curlews here because X.
Yeah. Why wouldn't
they? They're just a sign of a healthy landscape.
Who wouldn't love a curlew?
How quickly do you think the situation would be turned around, Mary? We are scraping along the bottom as far as curly populations are going.
And it may be too late in some places. We may lose them, but we won't lose them everywhere because they are still hanging on in certain places. But with constant increased awareness, with constant sort of education drives, social media drives, these workshops, these toolkits, getting ordinary people involved, getting people proud of their natural history again. We need to get back to localism. We need people to say, we're global citizens, but boy, are we local. And we've lost that local bit to say, I'm rooted here. This is my home. I'm rooted in this landscape. And look at these fantastic things that live around here. And I'm going to do everything I can to look after them. When we engender that mindset, that's when we'll start to see big, big changes. And I don't think that's impossible. How quickly it will happen depends on us and the amount of money and the amount of people that get behind it. It's not all about money. It's not all about money at all. It's about will and spirit and people being prepared to go out there and shout about it.
I love talking with you because you take on really big problems, but you're relentlessly optimistic.
Relentless.
You are, you know, for you, there are solutions to everything.
There have to be solutions, or why would we get up in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
Why, if there's no solutions, if you just sit back and wring your hands and full of angst and say it's all going down the pan, and Twitter is,
it's very easy to do, isn't it?
It's
very easy to get into that mindset.
But people have done great things, and you stand on the shoulders of giants, you really do, who have never given up and who fight to the very last. And if you know, if we do fail, if we do lose them from Ireland, and that's a possibility, but at least we'll have gone down fighting. And that's not for us to know, really.
Mary Colwell, who went down fighting.
I damn well will. They're not going to go on my watch if I can help it. And I'm sure you wouldn't want that either, or anybody else.
It's such a pleasure talking to you, Mary. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Mary Colwell talking with me in January 2020. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about the, frankly, enormous amount of work this unstoppable individual is doing for Curlews, please visit Curlew Action, which supports Curlew recovery by advocating for conservation efforts, developing and sharing resources for field workers, and promoting wider natural history education. You'll find all that online at curlewaction.org.